any kind of additional tax to the oil industry at a time when companies are posting huge losses is a horrible idea.
Alaskans react to the president's proposal for a $10 per barrel oil tax. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the NTSB takes a TV crew behind the scenes on active plane crash investigations in the state.
We are a public entity, and I think the public has the right to be able to see exactly how we do our job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
President Obama wants to impose a $10 per barrel tax on crude oil. The White House says the tax is included in the budget the president will propose next week. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
White House economic advisor Jeff Zients says the revenue would be used to move the country to a cleaner transportation system and also boost spending on highways, transit, and high-speed rail.
The $10 barrel fee is paid for by the oil companies. The fee is designed to support investment and innovation.
Zients says the tax would be phased in over 5 years. Sarah Erkman, External Affairs Manager for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association Trade Group, says the tax amounts to punishing oil companies.
Any kind of additional tax to the oil industry at a time when companies are posting huge losses, they're cash flow negative, and they're just trying to survive is a horrible idea and would have negative consequences, particularly for the state of Alaska, which depends to such a high degree on the health of the oil and gas industry.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says it would be bad for the nation, but a disproportional hit to Alaska.
How do I explain that to Alaskans? How do I explain that to the people that have just lost their jobs with the layoffs from Conoco or LBP or some of the projects that have now been put on hold?
Murkowski says the idea won't go over well on Capitol Hill either.
I think there is absolutely no chance that a tax of this proportion laid down by this president has a chance of passing in this Congress.
The American Petroleum Institute estimates the tax would add 25 cents to the price consumers pay for a gallon of gasoline. With help from Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin, reporting from Washington, D.C.
The Legislative Council's case against Medicaid expansion hangs on the interpretation of the word required in Alaska statute. That's a point all parties agreed on during oral arguments this morning in an Anchorage courtroom. The council is suing over Governor Bill Walker's decision to expand Medicaid without permission from the legislature. Alaska law says legislative approval is necessary to add an optional group to the Medicaid program. Federal statute still lists the expansion population in the required category, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled states can choose whether to expand the program. Attorney Erin Murphy flew in from Washington, D.C. to present the Legislative Council's case. She told Judge Frank Fifner that given the Supreme Court's decision, the intent of federal law is obvious.
We think the answer is quite clear that federal law doesn't require this. And I think it's very hard to come up with any explanation for why the legislature would have intended required to mean anything other than what federal law actually requires.
The state takes a more narrow view of the law. Dario Borgeson argued the case for the Department of Law. He told Judge Fifner, Alaska statute tracks the text of the Social Security Act, where the expansion population is listed as required. After the hearing, he said the legislature could change the state statute.
The legislature, when it enacted the statute 40 years ago, clearly wasn't thinking about the situation today. And our view is that the legislature simply wanted the HESS, Department of Health and Social Services, to straightforwardly apply, what's the instructions of the Social Security Act are.
Judge Fifner asked both attorneys to address whether the issue of Medicaid expansion would be better handled by the legislature rather than the court system. Given scarce judicial resources, he wondered if he should slow roll his decision until after the legislative session wraps up this spring.
Giving the legislature an opportunity to stand up and be counted so that the voters will know whether they support or don't support Medicaid expansion.
Judge Fifner said he would issue a lengthy decision by the end of March at the earliest. He said his decision was likely only a speed bump on the way to the state Supreme Court. About 8,000 low-income Alaskans have enrolled in Medicaid expansion. A new report from a consultant hired by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee calls expansion a highly attractive policy change financially for the state. Mike Hanley is stepping down as Alaska's Education Commissioner. Governor Bill Walker announced the leadership change in a press release this morning. Hanley says it was the decision of the governor and the State Board of Education, who said they want to steer the department in a new direction.
You know, I believe that there are some things around the board's new strategic plan. I worked with them to develop that. There's three primary goals: modernizing education, honoring local control, and recruiting and retaining high-quality teachers. We've begun to put some meat on that. I assume that they've got somebody else in mind that they would like to help lead in that direction.
This month marks 5 years Hanley has been Education Commissioner. He's a holdover from former Governor Sean Parnell's administration. And in recent months, Hanley and the department have been criticized for what many see as the failure of the state's new Alaska Measures of Progress assessment. Hanley says he'd be surprised if that didn't play some part in the governor and the board's decision.
You know, I look back at it, when we put AMP in place and we went through the procurement process, and things happened with the vendor that basically made it really difficult for them to follow through, and it caused a lot of frustration. And, you know, I don't know that we could have foreseen any of that, but, you know, it happened on my watch, so, you know, I own that. And so the frustration we all have is some of it's with AAI, some people have it with me. So that surely could be a part of the conversation.
Board of Education Chair James Field says Hanley's resignation has no direct tie to the AMP controversy. Hanley will stay on board until March 1st, when Dr. Susan McCauley will take over as interim commissioner. McCauley currently leads the department's Teaching and Learning Support Division. She previously taught in Hooper Bay and was principal and administrator in the Mat-Su School District. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Kenai Peninsula school says its building is falling apart and needs to be replaced.
It would be easier for teachers, easier for the children, get these buildings replaced with a new upgraded school.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaskans across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
A new documentary-style series by the Smithsonian Channel goes behind the scenes with investigators trying to figure out why planes crashed near Juneau, Kinnickarm, and other Alaska locations. A producer of Alaska Air Crash Investigations says it's not another reality show. The TV crew had unprecedented access to information that's not yet public. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
From July to September of last year, a television crew from New York City embedded with the National Transportation Safety Board's office in Anchorage. Alaska Chief Clint Johnson says the crew got unprecedented access to 7 different accidents around the state. When the general public was outside the yellow tape, the camera crew was inside.
I think it's very important to be very transparent the way that we do our investigations. We are a public entity, and I think the public has the right to be able to see exactly how we do our job.
Johnson says the goal of the agency is to investigate accidents and prevent them from happening again. The show is another way for the agency to get those messages out. Alaska had about 80 airplane accidents in 2015, resulting in 22 deaths, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. The Smithsonian Channel is calling the series a documentary, but according to Johnson, to get access, the production company agreed to give NTSB some control over the final content. Johnson says he and members of top NTSB management in Washington, D.C., watched rough cuts of the series.
We had the ability to be able to screen and view and add comments and remove some things to make sure it's not only technically correct, but above all, what we're trying to do is be sympathetic to the families.
All the crashes in the series involved fatalities, often of the pilot. Tim Evans is one of the show's executive producers for the Smithsonian Channel. He says the TV crew was rolling when NTSB talked with grieving family members. He said producers had to get permission to use the footage. They also conducted their own interviews.
The interesting takeaway on working with the family members is all of them were obviously deeply affected and grieving, but each one of them said, you know, this person wanted to fly, and they knew what they're getting into. And it's a terrible tragedy, but they love flying, and they loved Alaska.
Episode descriptions allude to information that hasn't been released to the public. For the Wings of Alaska crash that occurred between Juneau and Hoonah last July, it says, quote, recovered in-flight data reveals an unusual flight path, which might uncover the true cause of the tragedy. NTSB's Johnson says that is accurate information.
It's a factual data dump. We're not saying what probable cause is, and we're specifically trying to stay away from that, but obviously the facts of the case will be portrayed.
Johnson says the crashes in the documentary are still active investigations. Final reports are still months out. But he says any information and supporting documents revealed in the show will be released to the public prior to the show airing.
We need to make sure that all that information is available to the public, not only through the series, but also through the NTSB website. So that's one thing from an administrative standpoint that we need to make sure that we release beforehand, and we're in the process of doing that right now.
The six-part series premieres March 13th with an hour-long episode titled Juneau Flight Down. Other episodes will feature crashes near Trapper Creek, Bethel, Kasilof, Iliamna, Kinnick Arm, and Big Lake. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Walmart says it's trying to do right by its soon-to-be-laid-off employees in Juneau. For example, it's flying in trainers to help with job skills, but it's also sticking to a corporate policy when it comes to not promoting a job fair organized by the state. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on how some Walmart employees were left in the dark.
About a minute's walk from Walmart, a small room in Greening Park has been transformed into a mini job fair. Up to 168 Juneau Walmart employees could lose their jobs this week, so the state organized the fair to help out.
We got TSA, Fred Meyer, Verizon, AT&T, Home Depot.
Ray Brogdon works for the unemployment office. He says the hope is that Walmart associates can find new jobs. And about an hour into the event, prospects look good. Some Walmart associates who have walked through the door have already landed a job interview. But for one of Juneau's largest employers to be shutting down,
it's a little slow right now, but we're looking at probably around 12 o'clock until we're done here until 2. It should start picking up.
In the afternoon, it does pick up. And Walmart associate Bradford Rich goes from booth to booth to speak to the store's hiring. He found out about the job fair the same way he discovered Walmart was closing. He read about it on Facebook.
Some other of my coworkers had seen it, and we all talked about it. And I didn't realize it was put on specifically for us.
Walmart announced it was closing 154 of its stores in the U.S. in January, and Juneau was on that list. Rich has worked at Walmart for 2 years, and he says the news hit him hard.
Best way to describe it is a family member died. When I went to work for him, I had planned on working there till I retire.
So he says he was excited when he heard the Department of Labor was organizing the jobs event. Rich is a manager at Walmart's Deli, and he wants to find something similar at one of the other stores in town. But working his shift at Walmart, he couldn't find any information that the job fair was even happening.
They would not allow us to have any job fair. They are going to give us a class on resumes, and that's going to be done at the store. But they will not support Department of Labor.
Yes, I had heard that. I had heard that they had requested that we not be on premises.
Heidi Dreigas heads the State Department of Labor. She says it's not uncommon for the state to organize this type of jobs response. In Bethel, when the Swanson's grocery store shut down, displacing 80 employees, the Department of Labor stepped in to help.
Typically, employers welcome that sort of interaction with a state agency tasked with helping to reemploy workers. So I'm not sure why there was that, I don't want to say resistance, maybe just decision on behalf of Walmart management.
Walmart's corporate spokesperson says there's a company policy. It forbids outside groups from engaging in any demonstrations or distributing literature at their stores. That includes the state's job flyers. But Walmart is bringing in development trainers to help employees with resumes. Lisa Milkey, the statewide rapid response coordinator, said she wasn't at the meeting between Walmart and the Department of Labor. The Juneau Job Center was, but they declined to comment for this story. And Milkey says she's not sure why the Job Center wouldn't talk.
So I know we have a good working relationship with Walmart. We have Walmart through Alaska, and they're a big employer that hire lots of people, and so we have a good relationship with them.
Walmart has 12 other stores in Alaska. Milkey says the Department of Labor did everything it could to get the word out about the job fair. They placed flyers in bus stops, convenience stores, even inside Safeway and Fred Meyer. Still, one Walmart associate I spoke with didn't know the job fair was happening, and she missed it. In all, about 20 Walmart employees scored new jobs from attending the job fair. Majesty Tawai'i was one of them.
Well, I like to socialize with people. That's what I get a lot. And I like to get along with people. I make friends easily. I don't have to get too used to them. I just walked up to them and said, hey, I'm Majesty. Nice meeting you. You have a wonderful day.
She says both Fred Meyer and Home Depot offered her a job. And she needs it. She sends money back to her family in American Samoa.
Every paycheck that I have, if I have that much, I send my parents.
The Department of Labor plans to hold another job fair for Walmart's employees after the store closes this week. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Education Commissioner Mike Hanley's departure comes at a critical time for Mount Edgecombe, the state-run boarding school in Sitka. The Alaska Native Science and Engineering program is interested in piloting an accelerated STEM-focused high school on the campus. As details of that proposed takeover unfold, Mount Edgecombe administration was looking to Hanley as one of their defenders. KCAW's Emily Kwong has the story.
Commissioner Mike Hanley has a history of standing by Mount Edgecombe High School. Last spring, when the House Education Finance Committee began asking whether the state could still afford the boarding school, which, as a residential program, cost the state $4.7 million, Hanley ultimately defended keeping Edgecombe as is.
I surely hope that there's not, across our legislature, that there's not support to get rid of Mount Edgecombe. It just doesn't make sense to me.
And last week, when ANSEP proposed taking over the facility, Hanley rushed to Edgecombe's defense.
Here's a program that has a proven track record with all the attributes and strengths in place that they felt like they would like to take over.
ANSEP was founded by Dr. Herb Schroeder in 1995. Schroeder spoke with Hanley prior to his presentation before the House Education Committee and laid out his plan. He wants to adapt ANSEP's largely STEM-focused summer program into a three-year boarding school that would feed students into the University of Alaska system. Speaking with KCAW on Monday, Hanley says he supports both programs and was disinclined to allow one to take over the other.
You know, I love Mount Edgecombe. I mean, And ANSEP is another great program in the state. We have supported them for a long time. I think it's fair to say that there's definitely a need to increase STEM protocols. But I also say there's a definite need for high-quality residential schools that allow students to go in all kinds of different directions, not just STEM fields.
ANSEP has recently clarified that its high school would also offer tracks in psychology, elementary education, and business management. Yesterday, the Board of Regents and the University of Alaska Administration issued a statement saying they did not have a hand in generating ANSEP's proposal. Their statements also expressed concern that the idea wasn't, quote, rigorously reviewed by the Department of Education and Early Development, which Hanley led. Bill Hutton, the superintendent of Mount Edgecombe High School, calls Hanley an outstanding human being and says that his dismissal is hard news to swallow.
He's been a big fan and a big supporter and made that known around the hill, I guess, a political hill, and that's really important to us with a man of that stature and position is really supporting Edgecombe. Again, I'm not presupposing that the next person is not. I'm just saying that he has been outstanding in his support of Mount Edgecombe High School.
Dr. Susan McCauley will take over as interim commissioner on March 1st. And in light of the turnover, Hutton says, we'll swing with the change and do the best we can. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwonk.
A new school for the town of Ketchumak-Selo is at the top of the Kenai Peninsula School District's list of funding requests to the legislature. But with the state in financial crisis due to declining oil revenue, their request may go unmet. KBBI's Daisha Eaton takes us to the tiny Russian village at the head of Ketchumak Bay to learn more.
Tanya Konev teaches preschool in Russian language at Ketchumak-Selo School, where she says space is tight.
The last couple of years, I didn't have a preschool, so I would teach wherever I could, like nurse's room, principal's office. And then last year, they made me a little closet. So now I have a little closet that I work with preschoolers.
So you're teaching preschool in a closet?
Yeah.
Where is that? Show me?
Sure.
Konev shows me the tiny closet where she teaches. It's colder inside than the main building. We can see our breath on the chilly morning.
So this is my preschool room. This is my second year in this little room.
The preschool in the closet is just one of the many far from ideal situations at the school. Tim Whipp, the principal at Ketchumak-Selo, says the buildings that make up the school are literally falling apart.
And most of these were built for homes and renovated to make it a schoolroom. Plus the buildings just, they're old and need a lot of work. And at a certain point, they're really not worth fixing up.
Whip says there are concerns about safety. A building that the high school is in has serious foundation problems.
Part of the high school is sinking in. And I'll show you when we go over there. It's definitely got a good slope.
Across town at the high school, you can see the building sloping down from the street. Inside, Principal Whip shows me the problems.
Well, the floor has got duct tape on it to keep it together, and you know the carpet's been here for a while.
David Kalugin is the mayor of Ketchumak-Selo.
We have three buildings for 60 students, and the safety here is not too good. And when it's snowing or windy, they can feel the draft, and it's cold inside. I believe in the high school they have to wear coats when it's really cold.
He moved to Ketchumak-Selo from Oregon in the 90s and says he's here to stay. He works as a commercial fisherman like most men in the village. He says he wants his two young children, 10 and 8, to get a good education so they'll have more opportunities. He says enrollment in the school has dropped a bit recently, but it will go back up again. And he hopes the school can be unified into a new single building.
It would be easier for teachers, easier for the children. Get these buildings replaced with a new upgraded school.
Standing outside the high school with the sloping foundation, he says if they don't build something new soon, they'll have to abandon the buildings.
One of the buildings I'm sure will be closed due to falling apart pretty soon. And we're running out of money to maintain them.
Kalugin says they've been asking the district to build them a new school for years. Now that they're finally at the top of the list, and the state's out of money, he's worried it might not happen. This week, representatives of Ketchumak-Selo will be in Juneau to try to convince legislators that, despite the budget shortfall, they should build a new school in their village. In Kachemak Silo, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Kuskokwim 300 Sled Dog Race Committee has once again raised its purse. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the race holds the second highest purse in the state for sled dog racing behind the Iditarod.
The 2017 purse totals $150,000. That's $20,000 more than this year's race and is the fourth time in 5 years the purse has increased. The committee is also extending payouts from 20th position to 25th. Race manager Zach Fansler says the race has attracted more sponsors while receiving higher contributions from current sponsors. At the same time, the larger purse raises the race's profile, attracting checkbooks.
You sign up new sponsors that want to get involved with something that's successful, and luckily it's been a pattern that's kind of repeated itself, and we want to continue to have that pattern.
Fansler also says the race requires little overhead, mostly due to a large volunteer network and sponsor donations. And as the status of the race climbs, so do the stakes. Race chairman Myron Anksman partly attributes the growing purse to the committee's decision to drop this year's 14th place finisher, Martin Boozer, to last place without pay for taking an alternative route and letting kids feed his dogs at a checkpoint.
The purse is getting bigger, the attention to the race is getting bigger, and we do take rule violations seriously.
Anksman says gone are the days when the committee can let minor infractions go without comment. Ultimately, Fansler says the purse increase aligns with the race's mission to promote the sport of dog mushing.
To run a competitive team, you know, you need to be training and you need to kind of dedicate and you need to have your diets figured out and you need to have a program. You're obviously selectively breeding and things like that. And the purses have to go up for the races so that mushers can continue to do it.
The committee is also raising the purses for all its other races, including the Akiak Dash and the Bogus Creek 150. Amounts will be announced later this year. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Daisha Eaton in Homer, and Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.